Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk program. My name is Jack Brighton. Brian Wagner is at the controls, and our very able summer intern is Crystal Marshall. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll be exploring the question, how long is now? The answer, according to our guest, Stuart Brand, isn't quite as simple or trivial as it might seem. In fact, if we could ask this question of many past generations, we'd find out that their conceptions of now would be longer than ours. But that was then, this is now. As to the future, well, another question might be, how long is that? In terms of temporal distance, it used to be pretty far away from now. The year 2000 used to be way out there, somewhere in the haze of futuristic possibility, serving as a kind of touchstone for our imagination of the future. But now, that future is only 6 months away, and with the pace of change lately, it's hard to imagine the future much beyond that. During the now that comprises this hour, we will talk with Stuart Brand about his newest book entitled The Clock of the Long Now. The book's subtitle is Time and Responsibility, The Ideas Behind the World's Slowest Computer, and it has just been published by Basic Books. In the book, Stuart Brand explains the rationale for a project he is pursuing as a founding member of the Long Now Foundation. I'll leave the details for him to articulate, but it does involve the construction of a very slow computer, really a very large-scaled clock, that will keep perfect time for the next 10,000 years. Through the construction and maintenance of this millennial clock and an associated library, the Long Now Foundation hopes to reframe the way we think about time and about our responsibilities toward future generations. As we talk with Stuart Brand, you are welcome in the conversation. If you have questions on the topic, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana. That is within the 217 area code. 333-9455 is the number. Outside of the 217 area code, use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL around Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Stuart Brand. You may know him through his previous works, including the Whole Earth Catalog and the Co-Evolution Quarterly, both of which he founded. He's also the author of the books The Media Lab and How Buildings Learn. Stuart Brand is also the creator of the New Games Tournaments, the Hackers Conference, and The Well, a very influential computer conference system. He's a founding member of the Long Now Foundation and co-founder of the Global Business Network, both of which are dedicated to fostering the art of the long view. Let's say good morning to our guest, Stuart Brand. Hello.
Good morning. How are you? That's a very nice intro.
Well, thanks. I'm really glad to have a chance to talk with you. Maybe to start with, can you tell us about the Millennial Clock Project and how you feel it could reframe our thinking about time?
Well, in terms of the book, this 10,000-year clock is sort of a nice crystallizing way to think about the very long term and responsibility and civilization as a whole and things like that. But part of its strength as a framework is that we actually are building a 10,000-year clock. Right now we're building a prototype, which is about 8 feet tall, that you should be able to walk up to by the end of this year and watch it calculating away things like the precession of the equinoxes, which takes 26,000 years, and other good long-term stuff like that. The idea eventually is to build a very large clock, ideally inside a mountain somewhere, so it's well protected and it's really plausible that it would be there working away for 10,000 years. To just be a frame of reference for individuals, for civilization as a whole, to just bear in mind that it has this long-term sense of itself, and I think that's the change we want to bring about.
Mm-hmm. Where is the prototype being built?
Prototype's being built in San Francisco, and the designer is Danny Hillis, who designed the current generation of supercomputers. He's currently a fellow at Disney.
Yeah.
And one of the engineers who works with him there is also involved in the design of this prototype. The assembly is happening in the San Francisco area.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a project of the Long Now Foundation. Do you want to say something about that and you know, some of the people involved? And you're also, it seems like much of the book is an invitation to engage readers in this process.
Yeah, and happily, thanks to the Internet, it's relatively easy to for anybody to step up and engage. We have a website at, not surprising name, www.longnow.org.
Yeah.
And that's a place where there's some conversation going on. There's pictures and demonstrations of the things that are happening so far. The idea of the Long Now Foundation is to foster long-term responsibility. And the two main things we're doing at this point is building the clock or the series of clocks and also setting in motion, figuring out what a 10,000-year library might be good for, and doing some small conferences and things like that on that subject.
The clock itself, you say you hope that it will frame for us the notion of time the way the first space of pictures of Earth from space reframed our conception of our home planet, in essence.
Yeah, that story is such a strong one because I was involved as an environmentalist in the 60s in pushing for a photograph of the Earth from space back in 1966, and we'd been in space for 10 years at that point after Sputnik in 56, but for some reason no good photographs had been taken from a fair distance of Earth, and when that finally happened in 1969 with the Apollo astronauts orbiting the moon and taking good photographs looking back, it really was a shift. And, for example, the ecology movement took off that year. 1970 was the first Earth Day. And the image turned up in, you know, everywhere, in photographs, magazines, and advertising everywhere else. And it was a gelling of the planet's sense of itself. And it really took over as the icon of the age, basically replacing the mushroom cloud, which had been the terrifying image of the planetary fragility up to that point. Well, the photograph of the Earth from space is great for space, for getting the large sense of ourselves, but it still doesn't include so well the concept of deep time and how we occupy time. So the idea of the clock is to do for time what the photograph of the Earth did for everything else.
Uh-huh. You say that just by thinking about the clock and how it will be constructed and designed, is changing your own notions about time. How so?
I'm sorry, I missed part of that.
Oh, you said that in your book you describe that, or you state that, just thinking about the clock is changing your own notions about time.
Well, it's interesting in the sense that when you take on trying to build an artifact, design and build an artifact, it can keep working for that quite extraordinary amount of time for an artifact. It forces you to think about materials in a new way, to think about how the context around such a clock might change. And people seem to enjoy stepping up to the design problems of that. So they say, well, you know, if you build it out of some wonderful metal and we have a dark age, that metal's going to be mined. The clock will be gone.
Uh-huh.
And then someone else says, well, you know, if they put it inside a mountain and cast the metal inside the mountain, and the mountain has small openings and large parts, then they can't be taken out of there, and they'll just be left there. If the seriously slow clock is in a remote site, that also is less likely to be disturbed by warfare and things like that. We want to build one or more monumental scale clocks in cities, and indeed we've had an invitation to build one in Jerusalem, and there's talk of doing one in San Francisco, possibly in Los Angeles. But the reality is that cities have a very high turnover, and they have wars and so on. The Library of Alexandria was in the great Mediterranean city of Alexandria. It was burned 5 times
right.
In 600 years. That's just how it goes in cities. So that's the kind of issue you start to step up to, and I find really intriguing when you're thinking about these things. You know, what are the good long-term, the long-lived institutions, for example?
A number of people have noted that we experience time in very subjective ways, and it's not necessarily a universal construct, that it's not necessarily the human experience of time or the conception of time, the way we think about it, is not built into the universe. It's more of a matter of our own, perhaps, psychology. And, you know, there are a number of ways that you address this issue in the book. And one of those, I think, is a very interesting sort of way that the ancient Greeks distinguished two different kinds of time. And I wonder if you could talk about that. I'm talking about Kairos, is that pronounced correctly? And Kronos?
Yeah, Kairos
and Kronos.
And Kronos.
Yeah.
And Kronos is sort of the one that we hear about, and it's in our language, chronological and so on. And that really is durational time, time of lifetimes and generations, and it's pretty much the same 1 year to the next, 1 decade, 1 century to the next. The Greek idea of Kairos is very much tied up with the idea of seize the day. It's the opportunistic time. It's the moment of, you know, seize the moment and run with it. And that's a nice distinction because right now it feels like our civilization is very much in the mode of Kairos, of seizing the moment and running with it, trying to keep up with accelerating technology and taking full advantage of the market economy and of the grassroots things that drive democracy, even though those have relatively quick adaptability, they have relatively short time horizons. And so it all feels very much like Kairos now. But meanwhile, Kronos keeps ticking along, and a whole lot of what makes the natural systems go and makes civilization itself go are these very long, slow things, like natural cycles, like the seasons, like the lifespan of a forest, like the manner of governance in one part or another of the world, like culture itself, which is very slow-moving and should be. So part of this process is to, in a sense, kind of make the world safe for rapid change by tending to the parts of civilization that don't want to change rapidly and probably should not.
Very interesting. We have a call to talk with, and I don't want to make them wait too long.
Okay, go for it.
So let's go ahead and talk with this listener in Paris on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus. Yes.
The conversation thus far has been so challenging that I'm reluctant to digress. But many, many years ago in Rockford, Illinois, I was a babysitter for Stuart Brand. And I'm going to tell you that nothing he has accomplished in all these years since has been the least bit surprising to me, because he was the most marvelous, challenging, delightful child, and I read everything he writes. I love hearing about him now and then, and he just is an unusual person, and I am so thrilled to hear him on our station. Thank you very, very much. Goodbye.
Well, thanks for the call.
Talk about time travel. That's great. I'm amazed.
Well, it's interesting. Rockford, too, is the site of the Clock Tower Resort. I'm not sure where that ties into all this.
Well, I had a very pleasant visit at the Time Museum there a couple of years ago, and was astonished at what Seth Atwood and the family has brought together there. I understand it's in transition right now.
Uh-huh.
I hope the great collection gets to stay together.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting connection. Well, thanks for the call. That was quite a surprise, I suppose. Following on the thread of the last point that we were talking about in terms of, you know, conceptions of time, long cycles, short cycles, etc., you elaborate a set of timescales you refer to as the order of civilization. And I thought this was a very interesting set of ideas for looking at the appropriate timescales for different kinds of human activity. I wonder if you could, you know, talk about that a little bit.
Well, the idea here was to try to figure out what makes civilizations robust. And robust means that they can handle shocks, they can learn from new events that emerge, and yet they have the capability of great continuity and great toughness, even amidst severe change. And the mechanism that suggests itself as how this actually happens is that there's a kind of a pace layering in civilization, as in many dynamic systems. I first ran across it in buildings, actually. And the point is that you have some parts of a civilization that move very quickly and some parts that move slowly. And how you name them probably would vary from person to person and even culture to culture. But the way I put it is that the very fast-moving parts you might call fashion and news, a little more slow but still very quick is the whole realm of commerce and the market. Then you get a little more slower to the what's called the infrastructure, the roads and highways and bridges and the airplane system and communication systems. A little slower than that is is an area of what I would call governance rather than government. Governments come and go, capital cities come and go, but the way a particular region of the world and culture tends to manage its governance is a pretty slow-changing operation and should be. And then slower than that, you get to culture, the kind of things that anthropologists study and that everybody is deeply immersed in. And then slower still than that is the pace of change in nature. And it's very important that nature is part of that continuity, because if you disrupt it too badly, then you endanger everything else. The point of this exercise is that the real power is in the slow stuff, but it's the fast-moving things that get our attention. And so, in a sense, we wind up putting all of our attention on commerce and fashion and things that are moving very quickly, sort of to stay ahead of them and stay in the game and so on. To the extent that that takes our attention away from that very important, controlling, slow stuff, I think we lose the sense of how to make our civilization go well over the long time. And we sometimes threaten things by treating culture or governance as something that you can change rapidly, and it wouldn't matter. Well, it does matter. And so the Russian Revolution changed governance in that part of the world in a very rapid way. It also tried to change culture at the same pace. Basically, everything in their society they tried to run it in five-year plan increments, and that was disruptive up and down the line and indeed turned it into a very fragile society. So that's a rough cut at the pace layering idea.
Just to sort of amplify that, here's a quote from this chapter on this. In a healthy society, each level is allowed to operate at its own pace, safely sustained by the slower levels below and kept invigorated by the livelier levels above. I like that very much.
Yeah, the fast parts sort of absorb the shocks and do the learning, and then the slow parts, and they propose things, and the slow parts do the remembering and dispose from all of the propositions coming down from the top which things are really good for the long term.
Yeah. Let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guest and invite other listeners to join our conversation. We're talking during this hour, Focus 580, with Stuart Brand, author of a number of books, among them his newest. We're discussing The Clock of the Long Now, Time and Responsibility, the Ideas Behind the World's Slowest Computer, just published by Basic Books, available in bookstores, so you can find it there, and you can join our conversation here by calling us at 217-333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And we do have a couple of listeners waiting. Let's go ahead and include them. Next, a listener in Belgium on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I hope this question won't be out of line, but I'm going to ask it since you're talking about time. Next year is a leap year, okay? And if I remember right, there is a definition of leap years that has something to do with leap years who are divisible by 200 or 400, meaning that that is not a leap year, when every other year that's divisible by 4 is a leap year to help take care of the changing in the astronomical things. Is that true? Do you know? I've been looking for this answer many places.
I wish I had the exact detailed formula on that, but you're right. This coming year 2000 would normally be a leap year, and as I understand it, it's one of the rare ones that isn't.
Isn't. But
and I'm aware of this as a problem because we had to design it into this prototype clock that we're building.
But if you look at your calendars, everybody's calendar next year has the 29th as on the calendar.
Well, then that's we'll have to look at that.
Yes. I mean, everybody seems to have forgotten this little obscure arcane rule.
And there will probably be another set of computer glitches like that happen with that, because you're right. It's
about the year 2000 problem. That's not the problem. Wait until you try to get rid of that day. So maybe somebody else should look into this besides me.
Okay.
Okay?
Interesting.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that. Well, you know, this sort of raises another thing that you mentioned in the book, and I was really kind of surprised to find myself thinking about this, and that is, you know, if we think the Y2K problem is something, well, wait till the Y10K problem.
Yeah. That one's a fun one to contemplate because, you know, just as Y2K was based on the problem of naming years with just two digits instead of four, but we're now, you know, you use four, that's good up until 99.99, and then
right.
suddenly you've got another built-in problem. And so the convention that we're proposing, somewhat humorously, but it may become serious at some point, is that we use five digits now.
Yeah.
And so this is the year 0, 1999, and next year will be year 0, 2000.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. Neil Stephenson was here yesterday. I don't know if
Oh, great.
Yeah. And, you know, being a big fan, I got him to sign my book, his latest book, and he signed it, he dated it, and the date had five digits in it.
Did he do that?
Yes.
Well, that's good to hear.
I've never seen anybody do that. I thought it was very interesting.
Neil was part of an early conversation about the clock at one of the hackers' conferences a couple uh-huh. years ago, and I hadn't realized that he'd stepped into it that way. That's nice.
Yeah. I thought it was amusing, and yet, you know, it makes sense. Anyway, we have a couple of the callers waiting. Let's go on and talk with them. Next up, listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you. I've got a quote from Robert Frost and then a couple of questions. The quote is, "Most of the change we think we see in life is due to truths being in and out of favor."
Mm.
And I was thinking, listening to you, that if you're slowing down time and you're looking for this underlayer, I was wondering, is that because you're hoping to find a way to affect what it is that it's incorporating? And if so, do you think truth is really what it's incorporating? As we go along, we decide something is rock solid and we kind of change our course.
That's a nice quote. I wish I'd known about it when I was writing the book. Because I think one of the things that emerges with this pace layering analysis of things is that when you get into it, the fast stuff looks like illusion. And the slow stuff looks like the truth. Probably there's lower still stuff that's truer than that. But there's a sense that we, as I think Frost is referring to, that we lose track of some fundamental truths just because they get obscured by all the, you know, swarming around with fashion and news and commerce and so on. And each time you come across those, they feel like a new truth. But as Frost suggests, they were there all that time just waiting to be noticed.
Well, is one of the reasons that you're kind of focusing on the slow-paced developments because you're looking for a way to impact it?
Yeah, I think in the sense that most of the people who are involved on the board and so on of the Long Now Foundation building this clock are people in high tech, like Danny Hillis and others. Who are futurists, and one of them is Kevin Kelly, who's been executive editor of Wired magazine and so on. These are people who are surfing basically the wave of technology acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really deeply imbued with the qualities of sort of the growing haste of our technology and of our civilization. They're comfortable with that, but I think they're also more aware than most that this is not something that is going to slow itself down, that it may just keep on accelerating. And for that to go at all well, you want to have balance. And balance means probably not only paying attention to the fast stuff, but paying attention to the slow stuff. And being careful about nature, being careful about culture, being careful about governance. And I think we're just in the process of figuring out what that actually means, and that is, I suppose, the change that we're trying to help set in motion here.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. You just raised an issue that, you know, for many of us is problematic, and that's the accelerating accumulation of technology. And as it accelerates, its acceleration accelerates. And it just seems like everything is progressing so rapidly. Not only is it difficult to stay on top of everything and keep up and even be aware of everything, but, I mean, one wonders how fast can it go until, I mean, it's hard to imagine that it can go much faster, and yet every year it does go faster.
Yeah, it's funny because when I was growing up in Rockford in the 50s, there was, you know, ads from GE, Progress is our most important product,
yeah.
And Progress was taken as this desirable thing that everybody should, you know, work on making happen, and it would be good for you. And now that we've really got it, I mean, we've got so much progress, we're careful not to call it progress anymore. We call it change, and we worry about it and brace ourselves against the force of change. And the question does come up, you know, there were serious worries expressed at the end of the last century about how with telegraphs and rapid communication by ships and so on, that the pace of civilization had accelerated so much that it was clearly in trouble. And we've had another century of even more of that kind of acceleration, and I think we're looking at the prospect of the centuries more, and it really does raise the question, is there a breaking point? My guess is that if everything were dependent on everything we're living at the pace, yet that it would break. And this is why I think pace layering is helpful, in the sense that it's saying, yeah, parts can go that fast and can self-accelerate, and you can have convergence of technologies. So information and computer technology converges with biotechnology and molecular engineering and all these things. You can have those things moving pretty quickly, so long as you acknowledge that there's other parts that that should not move that quickly, and just honor, respect, and preserve and defend them. I think an example of that is the building preservation movement, which I did a previous book that called How Buildings Learn,
right.
That stepped into that, noting that it was really a grassroots populist thing to start saving the old downtowns, even if they weren't all that gorgeous, just so we would have some continuity in our lives.
Mm-hmm. But it's also a very useful thing, a way to think about the environment, because technology is at a point where we are affecting and capable of affecting larger and larger systems of the Earth. And, you know, it might be useful to regard, you know, this long cycle of environmental change that the Earth has always experienced, and the impact that we're having through our very quickly evolving technology, and try to come up with a way of maybe segregating those things so that, you know, the short cycles don't necessarily impact the long cycles too dramatically.
I think that's a nice example, actually, of how the different paces can go well together.
Yeah.
Because accelerating technology is giving us ever better and better scientific instruments for studying the very small, for studying the very large, satellites and all that sort of thing. And from that data, we're getting the kind of information about deep, long, slow changes, like, for example, atmospheric change and climatic change. And at the same time, that accelerating technology is in some cases giving us the choice of living lighter on the land, of having less impact on these natural systems. And so the information industry is generally less disruptive than the hard old industrial effects of chemistry and resource extraction and so on. And so you can take the faster moving technology, and if a society says, actually, we want to keep a fairly diverse, biodiverse background of nature so that we've got plenty of variability for our crops and all of the resilience that you get by protecting nature, and you point your fast moving technology at making that happen, you've actually got pretty good capability. And I think that's hopefully the combined play that we'll be working on in the next century.
Very good. Let me read.
Next century, of course, keeps sounding like it's some time from now. It's week after next.
Basically. Well, that's right. And I sort of alluded to that in the introduction. I mean, it's true that for a long time, the year 2000 has been a sort of a benchmark of the future, and yet, you know, the future is now.
Future is now.
Yeah. We're talking this morning with Stuart Brand about his newest book, The Clock of the Long Now. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have about 20 minutes left. You can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-WILL, elsewhere 800-222-2000. WILL. I want to make sure we talk about the library, because it's a very interesting thing to contemplate what would go into a library that would be useful for at least 10,000 years.
I'm not sure library is going to wind up being the right word. A university would be an alternative one.
Okay.
The idea is to think seriously about managing information over long periods of time, centuries and indeed millennia. And one first sort of walks by notions like, you know, time capsules and storing things in a really durable way in case we want to go back and look at them later. But pretty quickly, there's some problems that emerge that can be stepped up to right now that you don't have to wait to have them be valuable. One is, I wound up doing a whole chapter called Slow Science, where taking note of the fact that scientific studies that extend over decades and centuries turn up some of the most important and valuable information we can get. But it's very hard to administer and to indeed fund that kind of science. An example of it is the studying of CO2 in the atmosphere that's been going on for 40 years in a hut on the side of Mauna Loa volcano in Hawaii. And that 40-year study has showed this increasing trend of CO2 in the atmosphere, probably caused by us and certainly relating to global warming. That kind of study is very rare, and one of the things I think the Long Now Foundation wants to step up to is work with scientists and with funding agencies to figure out how to make more of that kind of study go on. So that's one domain. Another one is, you mentioned the Y2K problem, an even deeper version of digital fragility is that we are basically losing all of our digital data every 10 years. And so medical records and satellite photography and scientific records and all sorts of things have this very short lifespan just because of obsolescence, because the media they're on are magnetic tape or optical discs, which only last 10 or 15 years. And the media can be made better pretty quickly, but the obsolescence problem is actually quite desperate and almost intractable, because Moore's law is saying that our computer is going to be getting twice as powerful every 18 months, and that's gone on for nearly 30 years, and it looks like it can go on for another 20. That means you have basically three revolutions per decade in the technology. It's very hard to have any kind of continuity of data, just formats, over that period of time. So this is an issue we're trying to step up to.
Yeah. Well, just to amplify on that, I think it's counterintuitive to a lot of folks who maybe use computers but don't get inside the engineering of them. We think digital information as forever, but really nothing could be further from the truth because of those factors.
So far, it has the capability of being forever, and it is self-correcting, and it's very simple in terms of binary, and that's a good universal notation that everybody in the world uses now. It doesn't take up much space. There's a lot of advantages in digital storage, but so far some also quite severe problems, and we've gotten familiar with the advantages but not really stepped deeply into dealing with the problems.
Well, the other difficult thing, just from a management perspective, is that there's so much digital information and so much being accumulated that, you know, might be indexed or unindexed or, you know, whatever, and just the problem of going through it and knowing what is there year by year seems to grow.
Yeah, it's interesting because everybody who wants to get online can get it and can really experience the taste of this and realizing how vast the Internet is. And what's on the World Wide Web is basically doubling every 100 days, and that just keeps going on. That is a whole lot of material. But the web is also a tremendously ephemeral phenomenon, and so you look at somebody's link, and a lot of times it's, you know, links to something that's no longer there. And storing, so that, you know, then the question is the internet becoming this really robust and permanent place where all of the digital data can live and be accessed and searched and so on, or is it this tremendously ephemeral environment where you can park things for a while, but you can't rely on it being there for very long? That's a profound problem, because our, you know, we're running our civilization more and more on the internet. And if it has a short memory and we wind up with a civilization with a short memory, that's not so good.
So is the library project, is this one attempt to sort of grapple with these issues? Are you trying to find solutions to these problems?
Yeah, we'd like to move towards solutions. I don't think it has to be done specifically by the Long Now Foundation, though we'd, you know, love to take on various pieces of it. I think the main thing is to raise the issues in a rigorous way. And then try things. One of the things we're going to try is there's a new technology which inscribes, using basically a chip manufacturing technology, to inscribe data on a disk, which is, you know, brass or silicon or whatever, in a very tiny way. And it doesn't need to be digital data. It can actually be optically readable data. So you can put 10,000 pages on a 2-inch size disk and then read it with an optical microscope. And this is an extremely durable material. It's certainly good for 1,000 years, maybe several thousand years. So it'd be interesting to start thinking about what kinds of information would you want to back up onto permanent media like that, and what are the easy, not technologically dependent ways of retrieving that. So that you don't have to have a 1999 Dell computer in order to pull the information off it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's specific things that can be done that start to look at the depth of the problem and what might be some avenues of strategic ways out of the problem.
Well, there's the issue of the media, but then in terms of content, you raise a number of issues that involve thinking about what might be useful for people at some far distant point, you know, perhaps after the fall of our civilization or any number of civilizations after that, and considering what information, you know, how to prioritize and you know, just what would go into this thing.
And that's the great curatorial question. That's what, you know, museum curators and librarians have always been asking. There's a lot of stuff going by, which is the important stuff. What will people want to see in the future? And the thing we keep discovering is that you never really know.
Yeah.
The Life magazines from the 40s and 50s, from when I was growing up, when I go back and look at those, I'm mildly interested in the articles and the photographs, but I'm absolutely fascinated by the advertising. And because it, in a way, says more about what the culture and the economy was up to than the rather self-conscious articles. So, in a way, you always want to be able to keep both or keep all of it in some fashion. Well, you know, the digital storage, the vast amount of digital data in the world that we were just referring to is actually surpassed as of last year with the amount of digital storage places you can park these things digitally. And so we are starting to look at the possibility of being able to store absolutely everything if we want to. And that's something that we've never had before in civilization. You always had to pick and choose what books and letters and so on to keep. But now maybe we can keep it all. What does that mean? How does that change the picture? Do we become absolutely swamped and crushed by our past, which is completely accessible to everybody all the time? Or freed up by the sense that we don't have to worry about which parts to keep and it's all there available, and meanwhile get on with our lives? These are, you know, questions that the technology is now handing us.
We have less than 10 minutes left with our guest, Stuart Brand, author of the book we're discussing and a number of others. The book this morning, we're talking about The Clock of the Long Now, Time and Responsibility, the Ideas Behind the World's Slowest Computer, about the Long Now Foundation's plan for a millennial clock and associated library or university or whatever construction ends up emerging from this.
Mm-hmm.
The book is published by Basic Books, so you can take a look at it. And if you want to join us in the few minutes remaining, please call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-WILL, elsewhere 800-222-WILL.
And after the 10 minutes, it's longnow.org.
Okay, very good. We'll make sure to mention that at the end, too. One of the ideas for the library, or whatever it's going to be called, that I really was intrigued by is the idea of a responsibility record to deal with some of the debates that we seem to always be having and not able to resolve.
Well, thank you. That's one I've been pushing. Yeah. It's a what we're trying to do is, you get a sense when people are arguing, you know, in the press and in political gatherings about issues that you're pretty sure have long-term consequences, that though the deep future is often referred to, you know, our grandchildren will curse us for doing this, that, or the other thing, that pretty much the considerations that both sides are talking about are pretty near-term. What you would like is a feedback capability, a loop that actually reaches 50 or 100 years into the future that impinges on that debate. And so the idea for a responsibility record is that when there's debate like that going on, that a very careful record is kept from both or multiple sides of the debate and is put in the 10,000-year library with a wake-up on it, or a set of wake-ups. This data, this set of records will call attention to itself 20 years in the future, 50 years in the future, 100 years, whatever, and basically ask the question, well, how did it work out? Who was right? Who was wrong? What arguments were actually important and what were completely irrelevant? Were the terms of debate, did they bear any relation to what happened whatsoever? And two potentially good things might come out of that if you do a fair amount of it. One would be that the people having the debate are put in the situation of feeling that history and posterity is really watching, that the things that they decide will be kept in mind as events emerge. And then if you do a fair amount of this, you might gradually develop a good discipline of how to have that kind of debate. When you go back a number of times, 30 and 50 years later, and say, well, this debate was well managed, or this side was really right, what do we learn from that? And just get a better practice of having these debates and feeling that they really are connected to their outcomes.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them before we run out of time. This is a listener in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. One of the aspects that we individually regard and think of is longevity, and it seems as though we have to go twice as fast just to stay in place, and in contrast to some parts of the world where it's more idyllic and pastoral, mm-hmm. and people have no problem with the longevity because they're free of the stress of having to run twice as fast just to keep in place. So along that line, I was wondering what you had to say about it.
Well, it's tricky. Some of that idyllic pastoral life is regarded by the people stuck in it as boring. If they get the ability to go to a city and run as fast as they can, often they go there, even though conditions in the city may be tough. It's
well, we're certainly used
many other societies are really comfortable with a slow term, and you go back into the mountains of Southeast Asia. There's basically a medieval pace of events, and people very very comfortable in it, and you know, one feels envious hanging around it. I think it would be a shame if everybody in the world got into the hectic urban pace. To some extent, we're probably going to be looking at more of that. But also, you've got some people, as you suggest, who are saying, in a way, that's boring. Rushing becomes so tiresome that what's the point?
Full of stress.
And the stress. And by, you know, by and by, you run and you learn a bunch of stuff, and one of the things you learn is you don't have to run.
Well, one of the things Buckminster Fuller was asked what he hoped for mankind was a telephone for every person to have, so that now that we have the internet and so forth, they can maybe tune into the information. But just to put things in perspective, I understand the internet is at the present stage is regarded as a two-lane highway, and it's already being worked on so that the next generation it'll be a 16-lane highway. Mm-hmm. And there's another plan for improving on that. So we really are expanding faster and faster. far removed from what someone like Teilhard de Chardin had in mind,
I suppose.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think the point on the internet is that it is so much of a grassroots phenomenon, both in the way it's organized and in the effect it has, that in a sense it'll be self-modulating in a healthy way, because there really is nobody in charge and it's not hierarchical.
We just have maybe about 3 minutes left, and I also want to make sure to give you a chance to invite people to participate in this project, as you do in the book. But there is one idea I wanted to make sure to mention, and that is your notion of sustained endeavor. How, with the pace of change, it seems like we can sustain short-term projects, but it's very difficult for us to think of something, building something that would take maybe 50 years of effort. But, you know, many things, if we thought about it, would be really worthwhile making that effort.
Yeah, I think the one of the things that happens is when society runs across problems there's no way in the world to fix that problem in 3 years, 4 years. We figure it's unsolvable. Well, it's not unsolvable. It just takes more than 4 years to solve it. We've kind of given up on that perspective. And likewise, even when we went to the moon, it was we shall land the moon, man on the moon, return him to Earth in this decade. There's a sense that we had to just zoom there, and it's one of the reasons I think that the space program kind of came to a standstill after that, because we went too fast. One of the attractions to me of growing interest in Mars is that there's pretty much no way to rush to Mars. That really is a multi-generation project. And when you have multi-generation projects going on, everybody, I think, gets a feeling of just a framing of their lives and of a sense of kind of optimism that there's this big, slow, amazing thing that we can engage in together. And it changes perspective on what's going on. This is also, I think, one of the attractions of doing very long-term science, is that you're part of an ongoing process. When I was in the military, there was one of the enjoyable things is that you sense that these military branches have been around for a long time and will be, and you're part of that. You're in a old university, you feel that way. Old cities in Europe and in Asia have a feeling of when you're participating in them, you're participating in a big, long, slow life, and that's a great relief and an inspiration. Looks to me like we could do lots more of that.
Well, we're going to have to stop since we're here at the end of our time, but I would suggest for folks, if you'd like to explore these ideas further, look for the book we've been discussing, The Clock of the Long Now, Time and Responsibility, the Ideas Behind the World's Slowest Computer, and it's written by our guest Stuart Brand, B-R-A-N-D. You may have read many of his previous works. The publisher is Basic Books, and you should be able to find it. And there, you mentioned a web address that people can get further information or kind of engage in a dialogue on this project?
Yeah, www.longnow.org is a place where there's information on all this as it develops, and also a place to discuss further.
Well, very good. I want to thank you very much for spending the time with us. It's been very interesting.
Well, fun for me. Thank you.
Thank you.